You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
Hello and welcome to Sustainable Futures. This is episode number 29. Today on the show, we're going to interview Jared Manus on the Great Plains Restoration Project.
Our main goals are ultimately developing youth interaction so it can be implemented in many different communities, and then creating a few large-scale reserves that will allow some of these natural ecosystem processes, as well as a safe place for our endangered native wildlife from Buffalo on down, to flourish again.
And we're going to begin a three-part interview with Jeff Buckley on the Natural Health Products Association.
The petition that was signed basically saying, don't treat our foods as drugs, protect our access. I was told by Parliamentary Aid had more signatures than any other petition in Canadian history. And the citizens forced the government to back down. The Minister of Health at the time was Alan Rock, and he had been bringing in some cost recovery regulations that he had to back down on.
I'm Ryan Fletcher, and you are listening to Sustainable Futures. On the show today, we have the feature interview of Jared Manus on the Great Plains Restoration Project. This was a fun interview to do because coming into the interview, I really didn't have much of an idea of what this project is. So certainly was interesting, the little blurb I read about it. But I wasn't entirely sure what the entire goal was. And then I went to find out that it was really a fantastic project that involves youth and ecological restoration, education on the historical past of the region of southern United States and the Great Plains, akin to our prairies in many ways. And yeah, it was great fun. And this is the interview with Jared Manus. Hello, this is Ryan Fletcher of Sustainable Futures, and today I'm interviewing Jared Manus of the Great Plains Restoration Council. Welcome to the show, Jared.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's great. What is the Great Plains Restoration Council?
Well, Great Plains Restoration Council, we're a nonprofit organization based here in Fort Worth, Texas, and we have a satellite office on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. We've been a nonprofit for 9 years, and one of the main founders of the ecological health movement, which basically looks at healing and strengthening ourselves through healing and strengthening the damaged earth. And so we have protected so far over 18,000 acres, and we run a youth program, Plains Youth Interaction, in both states concurrently.
So you're healing the land?
I guess I should backtrack for a moment. I don't know how familiar people are with what's happened out here on the Great Plains, but it's absolutely shattered naturally as far as like the natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
Devastated. I mean, whereas you may have some place up there on the rain coast where you have a million acres or more or elsewhere, you know, we had just patches, 1,000 acres here or there. If that, almost everything, almost the entire region has been damaged or devastated in some way. So we live like in a place that's been very, very damaged. And most of our wildlife, if they haven't been killed off, hangs on by tooth and nail to get through each day. Mm-hmm. And I just saw, I basically saw that this devastation that is in our native ecosystems is similar in many ways to the devastation in many of our communities. So I said, well, why don't we do something that helps heal both? And then that could be a model as well as metaphor for people in any bioregion.
Mm-hmm. So it's by healing the land, you're working with people?
Yes. Ecological health, as defined, is the interdependent health of humans, animals, and ecosystems. Practically applied, we will look at, people would check out our website, gprce.org, and then go to the Youth Interaction Program. You'll see what we have, our trademarked youth wheel, which took some time to develop. But basically, if you envision the high-end, like titanium racing bike, if you fix a wheel, if you imagine that, the axle of that wheel would be an ecosystem project of the prairies and plains. And then the spokes of that wheel might be anything from, you know, history of the Great Plains, its wildlife and people, to culture, identity, and diversity, to mm-hmm. literature and the arts, tactical problem solving, community organizing, character building, anything, physical work, anything that would help a young person develop to become a full life, which is the rim of, say, personal responsibility, introspection, trust, cooperation, mm-hmm. consequence of action, etc. So we use a model of actively working to protect and restore wild nature, and through that, build up our own selves.
Okay.
And it's rather than continue on a culture of separateness, which we might argue is a root of all of our problems.
Right, yeah. Okay. Now, so, yeah, we're in a bit of a rainforest situation here. It's sort of a temperate rainforest. What is a Great Plains landscape like? Maybe you could just describe that a little bit for us. It might be quite like our prairies here, but I'm not entirely certain.
It's open country, and it's a land of sun, wind, grass, and blue sky.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, Great Plains used to represent the most abundant terrestrial ecosystem landscape, anyway, in terms of sheer volume ever to exist on Earth. I mean, if you can picture for a moment, at one point, like 65 million buffalo running on top of 5 billion prairie dogs and huge continental migrations of birds, cranes, ducks, geese, passenger pigeons, which are extinct. You have wolves, you had elk, you had antelope, you had just this like profusion of life that lived out here. And because it was so, I'm grizzly bears as well, because it was so large and so immense, everything was connected from the streams and rivers to the grasslands. It's a land of extremes as well, meaning just over the top. It was never meant to be broken up or a pastoral garden or chopped up. It's like if you took the ocean and walled it off into 160 acres of concrete, it would stagnate and die. Well, that mm-hmm. just didn't happen alone, but there was an outright attack against the animals as well as the native people who lived out here. Vicious, if you don't follow, I'll be real honest, but it was like a war of killing. And so all that abundance, all that life, that Garden of Eden, profuseness of health and vitality was just attacked and shattered and torn down, and all the animals were killed off. The rivers, creeks, and streams and springs were destroyed, and the land was chopped up into pieces. It was either plowed or it was overgrazed, and so we're left now with just tiny fragments of absolutely striking beauty in a sea of devastation. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of pain out here on our landscape, you mm-hmm. know. So if you look at that, and rather than accept that doom, that ecological collapse, which now some other bioregions are nearing, we are working toward our recovery as like a model for others. First of all, not to get here, not to get to that point, but that you can actually, history is not over and it's not hopeless.
Okay. So what are some things that you do to restore the land? What are some applications?
Right now we have three reserves. One's in the tallgrass prairie. Real briefly, there's a tallgrass prairie, which is in the more rainfall, heavier rainfall areas to the east. Then you have the midgrass prairies in the middle part, and then this, up to the Rocky Mountain front, you have the shortgrass prairies. We have three reserves. There's like we're trying to save tallgrass prairie, 2,000-acre park on the that we're working to create it as a park. That's just on the edge of Fort Worth, Texas. Then we have our big flagship project, which is 200 miles northwest of Fort Worth in Texas, which is in that's 12,000 acres. That's in the rolling plains. It's mostly in Copper Breaks kind of country. And then up in South Dakota, adjacent to Badlands National Park, the North Unit, there was a ranch there that was had 6.5 miles frontage on the most sensitive area of that national park, and it was going into foreclosure, and a prairie dog killing club out of Sioux Falls wanted it, but we were able to find a funder to purchase that.
Nice.
And so now we are in the park had long wanted it, but they weren't able to move as quickly. We have it protected, and we're in a long process of getting appropriations for the park to bring it into their fold. So we're actually expanding a national park. Now, to answer your question, even some of these areas, while they may protect good remnants, there are areas within or directly adjacent that have been plowed or severely damaged, maybe overgrown in brush, or the actual restoration ecology processes need to take place out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Since we're all about health and vitality, a lot of the core of the work, which you try to set as examples, is our youth teams. They get out there, they learn how the ecosystem works. They also learn how the ecosystem of their own bodies work.
Oh, cool, yeah.
You know, creeks and streams, blood streams, health of both, and they see the connectivity. So when they get out there, they're actually supported by, say, restoration ecologists. They literally work towards rebuilding parts of this damaged landscape. And then, you know, they're supported by mentors and counselors and social workers to process that work into something that helps them get a greater grip on their own lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really cool the way you're talking about the inner part of it. That's you're talking your inner landscape, like your inner systems of your body, the bloodstreams and things like that. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Body and earth, soul and soil. That's what I say.
Yeah, yeah.
I just have never seen... there isn't a separateness, and there's actually a lot of similarities. Like on the Fort Worth Prairie Park, with the tallgrass area that we are working at, there's a couple creeks that crease through the property, and they see how like the continuity and how they tie the whole system together. And then, you know, they look at the veins in their arms, and they literally study like the health of their circulatory system. Then they look at damage or threats or pollution of both, and it really helps them process into more personal responsibility. In our youth interaction program, since we only right now can serve a limited number of youth, I've chosen to give the opportunity to some youth who have some of the hardest problems, whether it's HIV/AIDS or domestic violence or a whole bunch of other things that may cause a young person to barely feel like they can have any say in his or her life. So one of the goals of this would be then developing that tangible understanding that, you know, first of all, your life is meaningful, you're not disposable, but you have responsibility and actual empowerment to make something, to even provide service to others rather than just be a recipient of services.
Mm-hmm.
You have the ability to make change in your own life, tangible, measurable improvement. And so the health of both is absolutely everything that we inform our work with. And we try to make sure that it's self-generated rather than a teacher top-down kind of thing. Like the last session we had, they started working on someplace that just a small area that was just completely just damaged. It was a small area, but they were working on it. They first thought they were turning nothing into something. And then we looked at it deeper and we started thinking about energy. And we realized, well, it was something at one point. So they got to the point where they were putting something into something because their energy was going to that. And then it came down to cultivation of self, as well as like the native prairie. You reap what you sow, seeds, ripple effect, cause and effect, law of consequences, and all this then gets applied directly to the hardcore situations that they have to go through each day. And so they're not like other outdoor, quote-unquote, education folks. They're not visitors to nature and not visitors to their own lives, but it's per every situation is health and vitality, and steps toward that is permeated throughout.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What are some of the things that have happened to destroy the Great Plains over history? I mean, one thing that a lot of Canadians are definitely hearing about is the oil sands project up here. You probably have heard a little bit about that. The oil exploration in Alberta that is, yeah. There's actually a really good article in the National Geographic showing some of the stuff.
I just read it day before yesterday.
Yeah.
And that was, I've heard about it and tried not to overwhelm myself with these giant doom stories like that in Indonesia and all that, but I need to stay informed. I think it's, I don't know what the answer is to that. You know, that seems to me like just a, it seems like a money thing. You know,
it very much is, yeah.
You know, nobody with any sense would really, you would think, would want that to happen, even with the increase in, I guess, cancer clusters and the fish being in those weird red spots and just absolute destruction. I guess it's, Ryan, it comes down to maybe a continuation of a mindset that I guess others are trying to work past, and that is this, what I consider just a pathological violence, which is an old culture that seems to have inability to stop, whether it's greed-driven or there are other things going on. It seems to drive forward relentlessly, causing so much damage without any consequence of action. Certainly that permeates our entire region here on the Great Plains, you know. And what I previously described, all the destruction, the complete lack of value of life itself.
Yeah. Would you say then that when someone is, you know, drilling into the land or really destroying a natural landscape, are they actually inflicting pain on their own health?
Unquestionably, but maybe there certainly is a mindset in certain quarters where that may, some individuals may feel that it won't come back to them in some way, but we all live on a very tiny planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I mean, right behind me, the kids put up this poster. It's a young Cree girl, and it's, you probably heard of that saying, relatively famous saying. It says, only after the last tree has been cut down, only after the last river has been poisoned, only after the last fish has been caught, only then will you realize that money cannot be eaten.
That's very applicable, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's so crisis and opportunity sometimes come at the same time.
Yeah.
What I just try to help people reach for when, I mean, it's easy to become overwhelmed. So if people are looking at the absolute monstrosity of the oil sands project, and you look at it, it makes no sense. Then they see all the other things going on in the world. I really encourage people to just really take time to make sure that they focus on keeping their own selves healthy and vital. Not turn a blind eye in a way, but things are not hopeless. We're just in a time period that's going to probably take about 20, 30 years. Many people will say it's unrealistic that we can do this, but we just have to realize it's one of these periods of time in history that is going to require a real severe challenge to get through. And, you know, we are losing things, and I mean, on a daily basis, and we have to, I'm not saying, in some ways we have to accept the violence that's going on so you don't go crazy on it. Well, you can accept the acknowledgement of that.
Right.
You don't have to accept it.
Right.
And do what you can.
Yeah. Acknowledge, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
Because, I mean, I look around everywhere around the world, and I'm very well aware of it, and if I can't have those things drive me crazy. I don't accept them, but I accept the acknowledgement of that. And I know that what I'm doing and working in some way is helping towards getting us through this time period.
Hmm. One thing that comes to mind is with rivers. Now, I've read this book on water and how in the United States a lot of dams have caused a lot of damage to the rivers there. Could you speak a little bit about on rivers, damming of rivers?
Well, I guess I'll use my own region as an example, but it's very much, again, like the body. You choke it off and then everything downstream, or you load it with something and then it affects something downstream. We used to have tons of springs, creeks, rivers coursing through the prairies and plains of America, but most of those have been damaged or destroyed, and in many cases no longer flow. You have creeks that if somebody, like say you have a smaller creek and it, everybody downstream, meaning wildlife or whoever, it depends on that, but then somebody on their private property will dam it up, and so it's not big to begin with. Well, they've got their little pond there, then everybody else downstream suffers.
Right.
That's an issue. Most of the major rivers coursing eastward, ultimately, to the Gulf or the Mississippi, depending on where it is, they've been dammed multiple times. Nobody has ever really done really long-term studies of what ripple effect that will have, but it clearly changes not only your flooding, but it changes the whole ecology of that basin. It's been a problem. Having a wild, free-flowing river is almost unheard of. I mean, there are a few sections where that might mimic it here in Texas. Like, I'm on the Trinity River, and it goes all the way down toward Houston and Galveston Bay. And there's lately been some talk of, like, seeing over a time period how you might be able to look at the system as a whole. You guys probably have a lot more wild rivers than most places in America do.
Well, in the northern parts, we would, yeah.
All right. I mean, even the springs, they say on the Great Plains, three-fourths of the streams, in most places, like in the western half, about three-quarters of the creeks, streams, and springs no longer flow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And yet you look at some historical writings and springs, even in some of the more arid western parts, there are some springs that were so strong they would wash a horse away.
Wow.
Yeah, you hear the thing. You know, you hear the story. The true story of anything is always told in details. You know, so you may hear one sentence or two, hear about that, and then that gives you that picture of what really was.
Okay. So now thinking back on Great Plains restoration, there must be a natural link with the native people to the land. How would they, is there a natural partnership there with the Great Plains Restoration Council? Because they would probably have a lot of ideas for you.
Yeah, well, how we operate is we're based in inner city Fort Worth, Texas, which is we're primarily a black and Indian organization. And in South Dakota, the program is entirely run by Oglala Lakota.
So the entire program
is run on the reservation. And that's without spreading ourselves too thin. Our main goals are ultimately developing youth interaction so it can be implemented in many different communities, and then creating a few large-scale reserves that will allow some of these natural ecosystem processes, as well as a safe place for our endangered native wildlife from buffalo on down, to flourish again. So up there in South Dakota, that's entirely an Indian-run program. And down here in Texas, it's more generated in the inner city. But in you bring up an interesting point, because the history of Indian people in Texas, there's a good book called The Conquest of Texas, very good book, probably, in my opinion, the best one written about what really happened here. There was no interest or even idea of creating any Indian reservations. It was annihilation, and anybody else who wasn't was forced out. So you don't have any Indian territory.
Mm-hmm.
Or you don't have any Indian reservations. You have a couple small ones that have been repatriated, or not even from people who actually lived here but were forced out from somewhere else. The interesting point, though, is out west, where not much has happened since that time. I mean, it really wasn't very long ago since, like, the Indian people were conquered and moved out. So that's still very raw and recent history. And even the Anglo folks out there still talk about it in a relatively present tense. Most of West Texas area was Comanche country, along with some Kiowa. And now those nations are based in Oklahoma. So there is a partnership work going on with those. Now, in the 12,000 acres in West Texas, we're hoping to grow it to at least 100,000 acres. And there are some sacred sites there, like near the Medicine Mounds and things. Some areas that are out there that are real important to the Comanche Nation.
Okay.
Go down.
You are listening to Sustainable Futures. This is an interview with Jared Manos of the Great Plains Restoration Project. Now, I read it up a little bit about program here before we did this interview, and it seems that buffalo is pretty prominent in your literature. What is the importance of buffalo?
They're the totem. Buffalo and prairie dogs are like the bookends of the native healthy prairie ecosystem. And on two levels, they will manage your prairie for you. They're not like cattle where they'll destroy the land. Even their hooves have a sharp edge, so they're not flat and tamped down. They graze differently. They constantly move. They don't take out all the plants. I have an area where we have two genetically pure buffalo that have been reintroduced to the Fort Worth Prairie Park. They go down to this creek and they drink and they leave, and it truly, it's in, if there are cows there, it would look like those concrete arroyos you see in the movies that's shot in Los Angeles. But here it still looks like it's so lush. There's mosses and the creek flows and everything is intact. They'll go down to water and come back up out. They just naturally move their bodies alongside the landscape because their bodies are part of the landscape. Mm-hmm. And that's part of their ancestral herd culture and behavior. So in my opinion, or I shouldn't say mine, but genetically they were like at the top. I'm not counting native predators, but they were like the totem of the native grassland ecosystem here. The other side of it, prairie dogs, and they've been poison gassed or shot down to less than 1% of their population. They didn't exist in tall grass areas, but they once covered close to a couple hundred million acres. And prairie dogs are like, their towns are like a coral reef in the sea of grass. They attract close to 200 different other native wildlife, not even counting invertebrates. Just like a coral reef would attract marine wildlife, mm-hmm. more so than the surrounding deep water canyons, same thing with the prairie dog town. So the two sort of historically functioned together symbiotically, like the buffalo would come in and they would graze some of the grass lower and move on, and then that would give the prairie dog sight distance, and they would go ahead and allow them to move their towns a little bit forward. And then while prairie dogs, their burrows hold water in the soil, and the way that they make the grass more nutritious, so then the buffalo animal will come down behind there. It would be a sort of like this ebb and flow of mutually supportive maintenance along with fire of the natural grassland ecosystem.
Right, yeah.
Here in the southern plains, there's only 61 individuals left from the great southern herd that are genetically pure, and they're stuck out in a 330-acre cage out at Caprock Canyon State Park, and we've been working with the state to address that situation. Even the males and females are kept separate. When you look at them, you really sense like they haven't been genetically inbred. There's no cattle genes in them, but they're smaller, blacker, and they're very wild looking. They're like these prisoners inside this giant cage. A couple weeks ago, we shared release of three bulls that we'll hope for our new project. But our goal is to hope ultimately get those animals into a place where they can breed up their numbers again. And then as landscape level plains and prairie restoration, you know, moves forward, they will be able to maintain their place on the landscape. But right now, so there's only 61 left. And you also reach a point where they might become domesticated if they don't have a chance to move their bodies over the landscape like they have over millennia, great lengths of time, that could collapse as well.
Yeah, so they don't really work well with domestication then, because they're naturally free.
No, I mean, they're wild animals, and the idea is, you know, you've seen people start to treat them differently, like they're livestock or whatever, but I say they're America's longest held political prisoner. They suffered enough. They suffered catastrophically, and they're not relics of the past, but they're living, breathing survivors of a catastrophic violence, and I think we have a moral imperative to give them some room to roam. Same thing with the prairie dogs. I don't know if people are familiar with what happens to them, but there's killing contests. They have the Red Mist Society. They've been poisoned out. Prairie dogs have been here for a million years, and they're one of the main reasons why we used to be one of the most abundant landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, there's like they meet all five criteria of the Endangered Species Act, but they still have no protections, and there are literally like prairie dog killing clubs and where they use high-powered rifles, and they're really excited. They have new video technology where you can film the bullet literally leaving the rifle barrel and watch it travel the whole way to where it explodes the prairie dog. And they have different names for the way they're called red mist societies. They have different ways for the prairie dog, the names for the way the prairie dog will explode upon impact. And this on the internet, you can see it over there. But that's just indicative of this pathological violence that continues on. It's a direct link to what happened in the 1870s.
Yeah.
It never stopped. Yeah. So that's why we're trying to move something forward.
Yeah. I can definitely see the connection. How it connects to what we've been talking about so far, too. It's just the illness of society. And
absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so everything for us is like we're a counterpoint to our existence, self-definition through your own work being everything. We, our work is defined down to one word, and that is health in all ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you mentioned the tar sands. That is a huge source of carbon emission. Of course, deforestation and all those other things are as well. Native prairies, highly biodiverse native grasslands, are excellent sequesters of carbon. In mm-hmm. fact, people don't realize that the science is showing that with all factors considered, your highly biodiverse native prairies outperform temperate forests because the prairies don't hold heat. I mean, nobody has even ever really looked at how much carbon was lost into the atmosphere during the Dust Bowl when all those sky was broken. Because I could take you to a cut bank and I could show you 8,000 years worth of carbon, and it's a black line. The roots are what hold it. So another argument, until you get emissions down, nothing will ever change. Another argument for prairie and plains restoration is that you can actually start banking carbon right away back into the soil. First of all, protect whatever you have left, and then you can take a lot of these damaged, if you get up the scale of these damaged landscapes and start rebuilding in some of the native grass and other plants, you would immediately begin sequestering carbon.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that you will ever have what you did. It's like if I had been, I had been hit by a car a couple of times, but my body is never going to be the same. If your body was really shattered in a car accident, you might actually get back up to functioning and all that, but you won't be what you were before. But you could get up good enough to where you have a life of health. Mm-hmm. And that's how we sort of view out here.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So that's what we're trying to generate into motion. And you hear a lot about green jobs, and we're all for that. But the missing elephant, or I should say buffalo in the room, is green jobs and wildlands restoration. And there's a lot of people who need work and want to work. And our model is we'll also get that going and allow social services and support to help be a lifeline for personal restoration or personal advancement as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see investment. We already do on a small scale, but in the rural Great Plains, there's so much in need. There's many of these rural towns Anglo towns have been undergoing a severe economic depression for decades. You can go through thousands of towns, and the main street is boarded up, and buildings are falling apart, and the population continues to decline, and you could have good rural jobs for people, and you bring people together. You could have cross-cultural interaction, which we already do, and you can also provide jobs for people from the cities or volunteer opportunities to get people outside in nature. Because working outside in nature and not being a visitor to it, but the actual act of protecting and recovering wild nature does something. In fact, we just got a grant to explore trauma and illness recovery through protecting wild nature. So we're looking to partner with a hospital or hospice.
Oh, cool.
I don't know if you're familiar with some of those latest medical studies that are looking at, for example, somebody in a hospital room and outside their window is a brick wall, and then outside their window, another one is a tree or something. And then they looked at somebody who was able to go outside and walk around in a little green garden or whatever. Each time that you had a little deeper penetration into nature, the recovery and less relapse got strong.
Uh-huh.
Less. So we're saying that rather that you take that one step further into the cultivation of your own renewal of health is the strongest.
Yeah.
Because we've seen it already in the work that we've done.
It makes me think of a program I read about with Wheatgrass, Ann Wigmore, I believe, who started a program where people would go to natural landscapes, and they would basically, that would be like a hospital setting for them, and they would take natural wheatgrass, which is has very good health properties, and it works very well.
You're talking to an addict, a wheatgrass addict. I think intuitively a lot of people will get it, but we haven't made those connections before because we've seen nature.
Yeah.
And we've seen our bodies as separate from ourselves.
Yeah. But it's all connected for sure.
And so how is it connected? Gritty, dug in the trenches work of commitment towards specific practical improvement.
Mm-hmm. Just thinking about how to make a transition. One thing that comes to mind when you speak of buffalo and how they're free roaming and they need thousands and thousands of acres of land, because that's what they do for the land, is they really like you're saying with the prairie dogs and the buffalo and the interchange. But in today's society, like, how can you even begin to allow that kind of freedom for something as big as a buffalo? And people will probably be pretty terrified of them. So what are some thoughts on that?
Well, I guess it's a stepwise process. In the rural Great Plains, you certainly have room. Again, there is enough room to open up enough of a landscape for them to function, at least in a wild life, be allowed to live wildly within, right now, a confined area, meaning life, or I should say a perimeter fenced area. So that's what we're working at. The prairie park, which is tall grass, again, very, very endangered, part of the most endangered major ecosystem in North America. We brought these two, after they were genetically tested, we found that they were pure. We brought them out, and right now they're only allowed to, because of circumstance, only allowed to roam 800 acres or so of that area. But with that rant, they immediately reverted back to their ancestral herd culture and behavior. I hope to definitely expand that as much as I can. The bigger project further out west, we're starting in the back 3,000 acres, then we're going to go expand it to the whole 12,000. And at the same time, we hope to acquire through acquisition and conservation easements large and larger area. And we'll see how things go. Ultimately, in a few decades, maybe there will be enough momentum that I could see this growing over time to where buffalo are allowed to become just as like wildlife again. Especially in the rural outback where there aren't a lot of people and the cow and plow economy is really pretty much fading, though there's still so much damage. There's an opportunity for them ultimately to, at least in very large areas, become wild within that, and then sometime in the future where they will just return to their place. And, you know, you fence them out instead of fencing them in. That's long-term look at it. But you'll see at some point where people will get used to that idea again. It's just a matter of stepwise, and right now we just got to get them some room to roam within the current conditions. That's, you know, critical need.
Yeah.
And it requires resources. It requires money. It requires a whole bunch of dug-in commitment from many different aspects.
Yeah.
You know, even a genealogist, you have to working with universities, so how we can, like Texas A&M, so we look at how we can even track the genealogy to make sure that strain stays pure. We want to make sure that we're trying to find any remaining individuals that might have gone elsewhere, you know, because it's so rare.
Yeah.
But I'm not a hands-on intensive management kind of person. Like, if I get these buffalo back to a safe place, you know, my agreement with the rural county as well as the other nonprofit partner, Peace River Partners out there, that these animals will get to be wildlife for the rest of their lives. No ear tagging, no rounding up, no intensive management. But I guess that they've suffered enough. We'll let them just go ahead and be. And sure, they will have a perimeter fence, but the forerunners of a greater herd and greater health coming in the following years.
Right, right. One thing that I find happening now is that with the economy coming to basically the end of its, so really collapsing right now, in some ways it's drawing positives, because going back to the oil sands, things have been really slowed way, way down there because of the funding is not coming anymore. So is there anything similar happening there in the States where some benefit is coming from the current economical way really failing itself?
Yes, and there was a Newsweek article last week about the green lining to this.
Yeah, green lining, nice term. Yeah,
I guess, and you're looking at, I was glad to see the mainstream media looking at that. We get to that other part, we talked about crisis and opportunity. It has slowed things down. We stood in front of the bulldozers figuratively. It was for the 2,000-acre prairie, Tallgrass Prairie, that we were trying to save, the Fort Worth Prairie ecosystem. In 2006, the state was already on a fast track to convert it into 6,000 homes. We managed to raise enough public outcry to stop it. But then, you know, the housing market collapsed after that, and that managed to help us have more time since then. I have heard from others that there is some ending of rural ag commodities in some of these really high-end dry places further west that may ultimately move people over to something new. I even heard in Russia by Lake Baikal. I don't know if I'm saying it right, but there's a big giant polluter out there that has been shut down, and people are talking about how they can smell the air and they're feeling better already. And so,
nice.
What we're saying is that this is the opportunity part, is to look at a restructuring. I hope that people will learn from this that this could be an opportunity to create a more sustainable future, specifically without, you know, in specific applications of whatever we're doing going forward. The oil sands is a monstrous beast of the past. On steroids. You have definite movement building of saying, all right, well, this was shut down because of this, or this was slowed down. Let's do something different on the other side of this economic crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard, even, believe it or not, that the Chinese government is looking at that. Once businesses that have been shut down, government help is going toward those that will come on clean and green.
Yeah, people are starting to see the light, and hopefully that's what comes out in the end. I think as citizens, that's basically where we got to step in and push it along and really make sure that the future is sustainable. I really appreciate what you're doing with the Great Plains, and definitely connecting with the past and the present and looking towards the future. It's very good work, and I just want to give you an opportunity here. Is there anything more you would like to add to this conversation?
I did want to mention, if anybody is interested, Yes Magazine did a recent article that people might find of interest. Just Google my name and Yes Magazine. Yeah. That was the winter 2009 issue. They might be interested. I'd like to, if people also want to, I have a book out, Ghetto Plainsman. You can find that on Amazon. And people also will. But lastly, I'd like to invite people to visit, if they're ever in the area, to some of our project areas, because we want to start generating volunteerism opportunities, or just an experience of a region that was, you know, very shattered, but left for dead, but is now rebuilding its own life from the inside out. So it's a very unique area and a landscape, even just the experience of being under the great sky and seeing work on the ground. So we just want to send an invitation to all your listeners to come and experience the Great Plains and its future and possibility and its renewing fertility.
So thank you very much. So this has been Ryan Fletcher with Jared Manos of the Great Plains Restoration Council. Thank you very much for joining us here today on Sustainable Futures.
Thanks a lot, Ryan. We'll talk to you soon.
Now we'll get into the second interview of today. It's just a brief introduction into what the entire episode of the next episode will be on. It was quite a lengthy interview I had with Sean Buckley of the Natural Health Products Association. The entire interview covers quite a range of issues, but for the purposes of this episode, we're just introducing the Natural Health Products Association, how it originated, and the next episode will really get into the meat of all of the implications of all the things that are going on with natural health products regulations in Canada today. So Here is the interview with Sean Buckley. It's quite a fascinating interview. He was a very good speaker as well. The first question I ask is, what are natural health products? And we'll just move in on the interview on his answer to that question.
Well, natural health products primarily are the types of things that you would find in a health food store, and also the types of things like if you went to a natural health practitioner, like a homeopathic doctor or a naturopathic doctor or a traditional native healer, things like that. And it's a very broad term. So when we say natural health products, more often than not, we're referring to products that are made up of ingredients that we also eat as food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so things like garlic and cayenne pepper are two really obvious examples, or turmeric, of natural health product ingredients that are widely used, but are also completely in our food chain.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why has this organization began? What's so important about natural health products?
Why we formed as a group is we noticed a couple of years ago that we were losing products again. And for your listeners, just to give you a bit of the history, by and large, natural health products have been completely unregulated. And in fact, it's fair to say that most products in your health food store now are not legal products because we're in a transition period. So first of all, when we talk about regulation, people have to understand, especially those that have been going to health food stores for years, is they've been unregulated. By and large, they still are unregulated. But in the mid-1990s, Health Canada started trying to apply the chemical drug regulations to the industry, and where they were driving products off the market, and actually Canadians rebelled. And as I understand it, it's probably the largest citizen rebellion on any issue in Canadian history. The petition that was signed basically saying, don't treat our foods as drugs, protect our access, I was told by a parliamentary aide, had more signatures than any other petition in Canadian history. And the citizens forced the government to back down. The Minister of Health at the time was Alan Rock, and he had been bringing in some cost recovery regulations that he had to back down on. And he asked the Standing Committee of Health, he said, listen, Canadians are upset about this. Will you hold hearings and tell us how we should be regulating natural health products? So the Standing Committee of Health had, which I've also been told by parliamentary aide, the widest consultations of any standing committee in Canadian history, and they came out with a list of recommendations. And the message was clear, is that Canadians want their access protected and increased. By then, we're in the mid to late 90s. Their report came out in 98. Is Canadians were accessing these products in ever greater numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And the message to the government was, not only do we want what we have, like, so if we could freeze the market in 1998, no, Canadians were saying we actually want increased access. And then a mistake was made. The Minister of Health said, okay, we adopt these recommendations, and they asked the very same bureaucracy that was attacking the industry to now turn around and protect it and come out with regulations that were going to honor these, the Standing Committee's recommendations and protect our access. It took them years to come out with these regulations, now called the Natural Health Product Regulations, which came into force on January 1st of 2004. So they've been in force now for five years, although the industry is still transitioning to try and comply. And they are absolutely drug-style regulations. So the problem before was, is we had Health Canada trying to impose regulations made for chemical drugs on things that are found in our food chain, and it just doesn't work. And even the presumption is wrong. It's they presume that all natural health products are dangerous, and before you can sell it, you have to prove safety and get Health Canada's permission. And some people have said, you know, we like the sound of that. But the problem is it really leads then to you not having access. And it's also important to remember that south of the border in the United States, natural health products are presumed to be safe. They have the opposite presumption. And the FDA, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, cannot take them off the market unless there's evidence of harm. Now, there they're called dietary supplements, but we're talking about the exact same products.
Okay.
Now, how these regulations have then played out is you now have to prove safety and efficacy before you can get Health Canada permission to get a license and be a legal product. Products aren't failing on safety, which isn't a surprise. I mean,
well, what do they mean when they say safety? Like safety to eat?
The first hurdle is demonstrate that they're safe. Nobody's having difficulty doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle Boudreau, who's the head of the Natural Health Product Directorate, that branch of Health Canada responsible for licensing, published in Live magazine in January the latest statistics. I'll round the figures up just to make it easy. It was 19,600, but so, you know, just shy of 20,000. We've processed 20,000 product license applications. Slightly more than half have failed. And, you know, so we've lost a little over 10,000 products just looking at that window. That's actually a narrow picture. We've probably lost about 30,000 or 40,000 products, and I can explain to you why if you want. But of those 10,000 that have failed for safety, roughly we're talking about maybe 20 to 25.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't even mean they weren't safe. It just means that the people submitting the license didn't give evidence of safety. Now, that's not a surprise. We've never had a death in Canadian history caused by a natural health product.
Mm-hmm.
We can go back to 1867. But we don't expect things that we're eating daily to be risky.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that said, things like, you know, nuts and shellfish do cause deaths every year, but shellfish and nuts tend not to be ingredients in natural health products.
Okay.
Nor does fresh meat, so you tend not to have salmonella issues and stuff like that. But just getting back to the problem the industry is having, so we've got this presumption of danger, and it's actually killing us. I've already told you about how if we just look at the licensing statistics, we've lost roughly 10,000 products.
Yeah.
And the media focuses on those statistics and go, oh, it's not that bad. We've only lost 10,000 products. But that's actually a very narrow window, and let me explain why. So, for example, when the regulations were first coming into force, the very first manufacturer I spoke to was a medium-sized manufacturer, and I said, well, how are these going to affect you? And this manufacturer had roughly 120 products on the market before the regulations came into force, and they explained, well, we're only going to try and license 25. And the reason is it's just going to be so costly, we'll actually go out of business. And they explained that many of their products are actually, even without the regulations, they were such low sellers that they lost money in, you know, making them and stocking them and distributing them. But there was a need for them. A small number of people actually got relief from them, so they felt obligated to keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But the rules changed with natural health product regulations. I mean, they'll put you out of business.
Mm-hmm.
So they were only going to apply for 25 licenses. Now, let's use the licensing statistic averages. We're losing about little more than half. So they would submit their product license applications, and if they're like everyone else, slightly more than half would fail. And so we'd go, oh, they submitted 25, 13 failed, so we lost 13 products. But that would be ignoring the 95 products for which they're not submitting product license
right.
applications.
Yeah.
So really we lost 108 products. We look at the stats and say 20,000 product license applications, little more than 10,000 failures. You have to appreciate that that's only a narrow part of the picture.
Yeah.
Now, some of these 95 products have been dropped from the market already, and some are still there. Like, a lot of manufacturers are just waiting for Health Canada to say, okay, everyone's had enough time to transition. We are now going to take enforcement action against any product that doesn't have a license. So if you walk into your health food store now, the majority of products still do not have licenses. They're not legal by any stretch of the word. Those are starting to drop off, and they're dropping off
mm-hmm.
faster. And you can't talk to a retailer who won't say, oh, yeah, you know, we'll place an order with the manufacturer, and it won't all get filled. You know, we'll be told, no, they've now dropped this one and that one. One of the members on our advisory board is a Mr. John Biggs, who runs a chain of health food stores in Edmonton called Optimum Health.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, the spring of 2008. So these statistics are very dated. But he sat down and figured out how many products from the United States that he can no longer order to stock in his stores, and the number was 20,000, because many U.S. manufacturers, completely legal in the United States, in complete compliance with their regulations, but find that our regulations are just so onerous in comparison that they're not going to try and comply, and they just have gotten tired of products being turned away at the border.
Mm-hmm.
getting back to your question as to why we formed, is basically we saw that the writing was on the wall and that there was need for another organization that was going to be a little more vocal than the existing ones on raising awareness about the problem and then kind of waking the existing organizations up, and in no way want to be critical of the other organizations. Because one of the problems is if you've got kind of a wide constituent base, including a bunch of manufacturers and that, it's really hard to get consensus and get moving.
Uh-huh.
And not everyone in the industry agrees as to what the solution should be. There's pretty broad agreement right now that what we have isn't working. And it's actually right now the consumer groups that are really getting upset and on fire because they're recognizing, again, that products are going missing.
Yeah.
Okay, consumers, listeners, that about wraps it up for today's show. You can look forward to the meat of that interview in the next episode and then the conclusion in the following episode. As I say, it was quite a long interview. This gets really good, really, really good. And that'll be next week. Thank you for listening to Sustainable Futures. This has been episode 29. If you'd like to get a copy of any of the episodes of Sustainable Futures, they are available on the website radioforall.net. That is radio, the number 4, all.net. You can download them from there. And thank you for listening. And I'm wishing you a sustainable future.